We're excited to announce that our very own podcasting platform, Zencastr, has become a new sponsor to the show. Check out the podcast discount link in our show notes and stay tuned for why we love using Zen for the podcast.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Archaeology Show, episode 146.
On today's show, we talk about slave quarters in Pompeii, new thoughts on Homo naledi after a recent reconstruction, and 2,000-year-old toilets in Turkey.
Let's dig a little deeper. All right, welcome to the show, everybody. How's it going?
Pretty good. How about you?
Freezing cold. I think we're in winter now.
I know. I think we finally found it. Had to go north, obviously, but we got here.
Yep. South didn't work. Carolina. Now North Carolina does work.
Yeah, although we can literally see South Carolina from here. In fact, sometimes I think we might be in South Carolina a little bit. We're so close to the border.
I'm not convinced that we're not right now.
We definitely saw the North Carolina sign when we were coming in. So yeah.
Anyway, that's where we're at right now and for the rest of the year. So it's just going to stay nice and chilly. No, not as cold as some of those northern latitudes, but there it is. So,
yep.
All right. Well, we've got three news articles to talk about, and one of them, this first one about Pompeii, I feel like Pompeii and Stonehenge are two things that are probably in the news all the time. And one of the reasons is for Stonehenge, it's very captivating. People want to study it and it's very mysterious. So there's a lot of things, there's a lot of activity going on there. And Pompeii, the same exact thing is going on, except a lot of it is still covered under ash. So things are literally being uncovered every field season.
Yeah, I don't know what it is about Pompeii. Maybe it's the like ghostly shapes of people that keep being found. It just like captures the imagination of the public and therefore people keep staying interested in it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's definitely been villages and things like that buried in ash before. It's not a totally unique thing, but this one is a little bit because, I mean, it was an entire city and area, countryside, if you will, that was just covered in ash. It wasn't just the city of Pompeii. It was like the entire area covered in ash.
Yeah.
So it's pretty crazy. And the actual place that we're talking about here is a suburban villa northwest of the city, which, again, you think of Pompeii. I've been to Pompeii twice. We were there just a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I think of it as, because everybody talks about Pompeii, I think of it as the city was covered in ash. Yes, it was, but also everything else.
Yeah, and I thought this one was particularly interesting because it is a suburban village or villa, and it's not in the heart of the city, and it actually wasn't even covered in ash with the initial explosion like the main part of the city was. It kind of escaped it almost. And then the next day, another like small eruption is what really did this area in.
Yeah.
And the people who lived in this villa were like, sweet, we made it. And then the next day,
not so much.
The volcano was like, nope, taking you too. But you'd think they would have taken that opportunity to get out. But
well, I mean, they just probably didn't have a lot of experience with it.
Yeah. You know? I mean, who would,
like,
right?
Yeah. Who's to know what's going on? So,
yeah.
And it's not like you could jump in your car and like drive really fast. I mean, had time if they had left. They could have gotten out of the zone of the volcano, but I don't know.
Probably just weren't even thinking about it. They thought the worst was over. They escaped and then bam, here comes more.
Anyway, this village is called the Civita Giuliana, and that's kind of just a cool name. And obviously, in case you don't know, we're talking about the eruption of 79 AD of Mount Vesuvius. And cool thing is, when I was back in the Navy, we did a cruise in the Mediterranean in 1996. And that was the first time I went to Pompeii.
Mm-hmm.
And I also took a little tour that took you on a bus, basically, or vans or whatever, to about halfway up Mount Vesuvius, to a parking area, and then you walked the rest of the way.
Oh.
And so I've been to the top. I've looked into the crater, because when you get to the top, you can, there's actually a little like gift shop stand at the top. There was at the time. I don't know what there is now. And you could buy the same kinds of things you could buy in like the gift shop down below, but they had a sticker in them that, or a stamp in them that says bought at the top, Mount Vesuvius. And that was pretty cool.
Yep.
But it was really neat being up there. I mean, it was mildly smoking. It's still it's not a dormant volcano,
right,
by any means, but it hasn't, you know, fully erupted like this since 79 AD. I think there may have been some other smaller eruptions then, but nothing on this scale. So
yeah.
Anyway, that's what we're talking about. So what was found was something that we just don't have a lot of really great examples of, and that was slaves' quarters. Mm-hmm. It's an untold story in this area, and obviously Romans had slaves. Everybody back in that time had slaves. It's just like what you did when you conquered a people, or there was somebody that you could make do your bidding for nothing.
Yeah.
You got slaves.
Yeah, I actually was kind of interested in that because I was like, well, where did the slaves come from? Because, you know, slavery in the United States has a pretty clear racial story to it.
Yeah.
And in other places in the world, there's often a racial, ethnic, or religious story being told by why certain people are chosen as slaves, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I was just curious about Rome and Pompeii, and so I did do a little bit of research into that. And it sounds like the majority of their slaves did come from conquering peoples and taking them. So, and also a lot of Greeks, apparently. Mm. I guess Greeks and Romans were often at each other's throats, as we know. And so they liked Greeks for slaves, though, because the wealthy families could use them to teach their children.
Nice.
Because the Greeks were often well educated. So,
right.
So there's that. And then also there's a pretty healthy, like, slave women to make more slaves, basically, because any child born to a female slave was also a slave. So there were actually like groups of people who would gather up females and basically breed them essentially to make more slaves. So like, that's a pretty nasty underbelly to what was going on to all this, because I'm sure none of that was consensual and it was a really horrific experience. And then of course there's the brothels were mostly staffed by female slaves. So
I mean, it was a different time. Maybe they all liked it. It was just a career choice.
Oh boy, that's not
the brothels, but like the slaves. They're like, I think I'm going to be a slave, daddy.
I don't know about that.
Great, son. Let's get you over to some masters.
Yeah.
Yeah, probably not.
It does sound like in a big city like Pompeii, there's maybe a little bit of relief here and there, because the streets were so crowded that when a slave had to leave the home to go do whatever they needed to do for their owners, there was some chance to like duck into a bakery or hang out on the street or whatever.
A semblance of a normal life.
Maybe. I'm not. Yeah. I don't know.
Who knows?
I read that in one article. It was speculation, of course. So anyway, that's a little bit about what I was reading about the slaves in Rome and probably the slaves in Pompeii. So
yeah, what was found in these small, although not like super small, slaves quarters were three wooden beds. There were two adult sized ones and one child sized one, a chamber pot, a wooden chest filled with metal and fabric items, and a chariot shaft. I would have liked a little more detail. Of course, we're reading an article and don't have the paper here, but I would like to know what the metal and fabric items are.
Yeah. Could they identify them?
Like, I don't know. Yeah.
Was it just clothing or
who knows? Like,
that could be anything really.
Yeah, and I took chariot shaft, which is a weird thing to have in there, to mean like the axle between the two primary wheels on the chariot.
Yeah, what I read is that maybe they were doing some work on it. Maybe whatever slaves lived in these quarters were in charge of maintaining it or doing work on it or something.
I feel like if that were the case, you'd have found a lot more like tools and other parts and things. But I got the impression that to me, it seemed like either, you know, the owner, the master, whoever owned the slaves, either just like stored the thing in there,
maybe,
because why not? Their slaves' quarters.
Yeah.
Or maybe one of them did take it. So somewhat take it home or something like that and see what they could do to it.
It sure does seem like a weird thing to be in there.
Yeah,
though,
it's a really odd thing to be in there. So anyway, the room was very preserved, as a lot of things in Pompeii are. It was covered in ash. Like everything in Pompeii, the actual like wooden beds and some of the artifacts aren't actually there. It's their impressions that were there in the ash, because they're gone over time. You know, they're just not there anymore, but the ash hardened around them, and you can pour these plaster casts inside of the impressions basically and come out with it, which makes excavation in Pompeii a really interesting thing. So it leads me to believe that like once you start finding either a less dense area of ash, because maybe some of it has collapsed in, but a less dense area of ash or an actual negative space where there's nothing, as a Pompeian excavator, you've got to stop right there and kind of be real careful and get to the point where you can sort of fill it with plaster.
Yeah.
And then see what you have.
Yeah.
When the plaster hardens.
Like from an actual like archaeologist excavation perspective, that does seem really crazy and a totally different approach to how you would excavate. Yeah. I can't really imagine how you do it, because you're right. If you come across a negative space, you're like, okay, how do I do this? And then how do you make a plaster cast out of it without ruining it? I don't know how that works. It's cool though.
Yeah. Another reason this is important is that we can see a snapshot in time, like archaeology, you know, is what archaeology does, but it's a snapshot in time, as I said at the beginning, of a underrepresented class of people, because history and stories about this area are written by the elite class of people. Mm-hmm. You know, those are who's doing the writing, who's doing the storytelling, who's commissioning mosaics and murals and things that tell stories, and they're telling it in the story that they want to say. So whatever we found here is told from the slave's perspective, essentially. Mm-hmm. It's still the person who owns the slave's idea of what their quarters should be. However, you know, the slave's personal things and how things are laid out, I mean, that would have been probably their choice. So
I know. That's why I really do wish we could know a little bit more about what was found in the chest, because those would clearly be items of importance to these slaves. And I guess we also don't know, are they like a family unit? That's why they shared these quarters together, or were they just thrown together? And because, you know, there was one area for slaves and they all just mm-hmm. lived there together. Those are the kind of questions that I don't know that we would be able to answer without like written evidence somewhere. But, but it is interesting to speculate on why they were there together and what kinds of things that they stored and were important to them.
Right. Yeah, this excavation was part of a program that's designed to combat looting in the area. It sounds like it's basically, let's get ahead of the looters and dig everything up.
Yeah, that was the same story behind that chariot that we talked about a couple months ago. They're just desperately racing ahead of the looters to find this stuff before it's taken.
Yeah, looters basically dig tunnels into the ash and try to steal artifacts that are, you know, you don't need plaster cast out. There are things that still remain, of course, but that's what they do. And there's a lot of different access points, so to speak, into unexcavated Pompeii, just because it's super deep. And I mean, meters and meters deep in some places. And I just don't think they can adequately protect all of it. So,
yeah. And quite large, right?
Yeah. It's
deep,
huge.
And really large. So, yeah.
So last November, in fact, at this same villa, archaeologists found the bodies of two men on at the same villa. And they were identified, not sure how, as a wealthy landowner and his slave. That's all.
Yeah,
the article
I
says.
Believe we talked about that article last year too when it came out, because it was kind of like, well, how can you know? But I think it was by the clothing that they were wearing and the different decorative items found with them that they were able to tell.
Yeah, and we just passed an anniversary of the eruption. I didn't realize. I always hear 79 AD, but I didn't know it was in October.
Yeah.
Yeah, the October mentions the initial eruption was on October 24th. And as Rachel mentioned earlier, the second eruption on October 25th is actually what did these guys in. So I'm wondering, you know, the initial eruption would have had a certain signature for the people really close to it that died in that initial eruption. But the people who died in the secondary eruption, it's like, were they just hunkered down and hoping it didn't happen again?
Yeah.
Or were you seeing the people that survived that in states of like preparations to move? Like were there wagons or chariots or something buried with all their personal effects on them? Like they're just like gathering things up and
getting out.
Oh, like
they were trying to get out?
Yeah,
maybe.
Would they have even considered the fact that a second eruption could be happening? How much experience did they have with volcanoes? Was there rumblings after the first one that indicated a second one might be possible? I mean, there wasn't really volcanology back then, but there's really smart people back then. So who knows whether or not they could have even anticipated a second eruption.
Yeah, you would think just out of safety concerns and, you know, just a sense of caution, they would have taken off at least for a couple days while things settled down.
Yeah.
But, okay, like we see this in regular times whenever people are told to evacuate for a hurricane or some other major weather event. And there's always the diehards who refuse to leave their homes because it's their home and they've lived there forever and they just don't want to leave. And humans are humans. And I can't imagine that humans in Rome in 79 AD were any different than humans today who just don't want to leave their home. So, you know, I'm guessing they just like cross their fingers and hope that the worst was over.
Well, one thing I'm hoping they didn't have to worry about was lions. unlike our 300,000-year-old Homo naledi child, who seems to be also didn't have to worry about lions. We're not sure, but lived in a cave. Let's talk about that kid when we come back.
Chris Webster here for the Archaeology Podcast Network. We strive for high-quality interviews and content so you can find information on any topic in archaeology from around the world. One way we do that is by recording interviews with our hosts and guests located in many parts of the world all at once. We do that through the use of Zencastr. That's Z-E-N-C-A-S-T-R. Zencastr allows us to record high-quality audio with no stress on the guest. Just send them a link to click on and that's it. Zencastr does the rest. They even do automatic transcriptions. Check out the link in the show notes for 30% off your first 3 months or go to zencastr.com and use the code TAS.
Looking to expand your knowledge of x-rays and imaging in the archaeology field? Then check out An Introduction to Paleoradiography, a short online course offering professional training for archaeologists and affiliated disciplines. Created by archaeologist, radiographer, and lecturer James Elliott, the content of this course is based upon his research and teaching experience in higher education. It is approved by the Chartered Institute for Archaeologists as 4 hours of training. That's in the UK, for those of you that don't know. So don't miss out on this exciting opportunity for professional and personal development. For more information on pricing and course structure, visit paleoimaging.com. That's P-A-L-E-O imaging.com. And look for the link in the show notes to this episode.
Welcome back to the Archaeology Show, episode 146. And we are moving down to, well, South Africa, where all the cool things are found. And one of the things we're going to talk about is Homo naledi. Now, Homo naledi is a branch of... Not really. It's not a branch of Homo sapien. It's a branch of Homo sapien, you know, human like species, I guess.
One of the like earlier.
Yeah.
Earlier yeah. Homos.
It was one of the trees, one of the lines that developed. I'm not sure where Homo naledi fits in the family tree, though, but it's one of the lines that branched out from an earlier line that Homo sapiens is also part of.
Right.
That's why Homo naledi has Homo in front of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's human-like.
There's right? a common ancestor, basically.
There is a common ancestor, yeah. Homo naledi was first found in a place called Rising Star Cave in South Africa. And anybody who's paid any attention to human evolution stuff has heard of Rising Star Cave. This place is like a lot of cool things here. And I'm just remembering... One of the cool things about Rising Star Cave that I remember from years ago was it was really hard to get into. And they had a bunch of, essentially, it became female academics that were down there for this excavation because they tend to be smaller.
Oh.
And they had to get into these cave spaces that were just ridiculously
like super
tight.
Super tiny.
Yeah, to access the actual chamber in the back.
Oh, wow.
And that was just really cool. They just like, you know... Just went in there and squeezed in through these spaces. And,
oh my God.
That, and got back in there.
That sounds a little bit terrifying. Yeah. Like I'm getting a little claustrophobic just thinking about that. I would not be a good fit for that excavation.
Yeah. So as with a lot of these older excavations, and again, Homo naledi lived between 236,000 and 335,000 years ago. Well, although we don't have a ton of, I guess, archaeological evidence of Homo naledi, much like a lot of human evolution, there usually isn't a large representative sample, mm-hmm. but it's enough. And especially when we have a skull like we have here, you can really tell the big differences. But mm-hmm. paleoanthropologist Lee Berger, who is a pretty well-known paleoanthropologist, he's at the University of Witwatersrand in Johannesburg. Mm-hmm. Him and his colleagues reconstructed a partial skull that was found 40 feet from the chamber where the original fossils were discovered. So there's a whole network of things going on in here. And they found this one 40 feet from that original chamber. Hmm. And it consisted of 28 skull fragments and 6 teeth. And if you click into the Science News article that we have linked in here, the first one is the article that we found, and then the next one is the Science News article that article referenced. And you can see the skull sitting in somebody's hand.
Yeah.
And it is just...
It's tiny. You know,
an average-sized, it looks like a male hand, and... The whole skull fits in his hand.
Yeah. So tiny.
It's like and a softball.
And this was a child that they think was between 4 and 6 years old.
Yeah.
But the size of the skull, it's like smaller than a human infant skull today. Like a newborn skull. It's probably smaller even than that. Mm-hmm. So it's super tiny.
Yeah. And when you're looking at these, again, 28 fragments and 6 teeth, you'll see darker areas and you'll see lighter areas. The lighter tan areas are the actual skull fragments that they found. And the darker areas are the reconstruction portion of it. They interpolate what they think it looked like there. So
based on like angles and stuff, yeah. Like, okay, this is at this angle. And so it would have met right. this other piece. And yeah.
And they know a lot about skulls. They know a lot about osteology, human mm-hmm. osteology and paleoanthropological osteology. And, you know, it takes some time, obviously, to get the pieces right. But when you start looking at things that you know that are consistent across all species, like bone thickness from one place to the next, how does the thickness change? Especially in children, it would be different. Looking mm-hmm. at the seams, are they fused yet between different, you know, bones? And using all that evidence, they're able to basically place these in a space and then construct what they think the rest of the skull would have looked like. Now, of course, that's largely conjecture a little bit, mm-hmm. but based on really good educational guesses.
Mm-hmm. Educated yeah. guesses.
Educated guesses. Wow, I could not get that word out. So anyway, it's just really cool that they're able to reconstruct it like that and then give us a good view of it. But that's a lot of paleoanthropology. The papers don't come out like after the excavation. They have to do a lot of analysis yeah. on a lot of different aspects of it. I mean, for all I know, this may have been excavated years ago and they just got around to this portion of it, or it took that long to reconstruct it and put some stuff together to write the paper,
yeah.
figure out what this all means. Paleoanthropology is a very slow process. Yeah.
And if you look at the reconstructed skull, you can kind of understand why, because what you're looking at there is like, I don't know, 75% reconstruction and only 25% mm-hmm. actual skull fragments. So they have to spend a lot of time really making sure that they get this construction correct.
Yeah.
Because you're immediately going to have people criticizing and picking it apart when you see how much of it is a guess. It's basically a scientist educated guess. So mm-hmm. much of it is. So they really have to be able to like stand behind what they did and why they did it.
Right.
It takes time to do that.
Yeah. Now the controversial bit about this paper is, or I'm sure it's controversial, you know, for a little period of time, but I guess the really interesting thing that the researchers think is going on here, Lee Berger was quoted as saying that first off, a lot of the things they find in caves in these areas, especially down in Johannesburg, or not Johannesburg, but South Africa, there's a lot of cave systems down there.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of caves are, I think they're limestone, and you get water coming in from seasonal rains, and it basically washes it down through. So you could have, say, a tree, a common occurrence is like a big tree growing out of the edge of a cave entrance, which is flat against the landscape. And you know, so you're just walking across the landscape and there's a hole. Turns out that's an opening of a huge cave system underneath.
Oh.
So the water goes down in, basically down into the water table and erodes out these big caves.
Right.
Well, animals would see those caves as places where they could safely and comfortably eat and store their food if they needed to for a minute. So cheetahs and hyenas and lions and things like that, they would scavenge or kill prey and then drag it into these caves. And we've got some evidence, or at least ethnographic evidence, or people have seen it happen, of cheetahs and other things pulling their prey up into trees to be safe. And uh-huh. then the tree overhangs the cave, and then the parts basically fall into the cave as the animal's eating it.
Sure. Okay. Yeah.
But these, however, Berger says, don't look like they were either washed into, because Rising Star Cave is actually on the coast. There's a lot of water in there.
Mm-hmm.
They don't think it was washed into or carried there by predators or scavengers. And the reason is they can't find any evidence that these skull fragments or other bone fragments they found had any sort of, you know, like teeth marks
or anything on them. Yeah.
So,
and brains are delicious. So, you know, yeah. they'd be clawing that out if they could.
Yeah. So what they're actually saying, and it can't be just this one child's skull fossil that is their evidence. They might be pulling this together from other things they found in there. But they're saying that this might be a case for deliberate ritualized body disposal at 300,000 plus years ago, which would be kind of game changing.
That's yeah. true. I gotta say though, like my skeptic meter like immediately goes up at something like that.
Yeah.
Because of the absence of evidence of predators or water damage to these mm-hmm. to these remains, therefore ritual.
Yeah.
I'm like, well, also couldn't this child have like crawled in the cave and just died there too, and just
yeah,
you know, no reason other than he was sick and that is what happened, you know?
Maybe. Child probably wouldn't have been on their own.
Or it got lost, you know?
Yeah.
Like, there's a there's a lot of reasons why a kid in this really rough landscape of, you know, 300,000 years ago or whatever it was, could have potentially ended up separated from its family and then crawled in the cave and died. So I think it's a little bit early to say that. And there might be some other evidence that they're not talking about in this article or that they haven't shared yet to make them really believe that it's some kind of deliberate body disposal or burial or whatever. Mm-hmm. But they certainly aren't mentioning it in this article. So I'm immediately skeptical. Surprise, surprise.
All right, then. Well, much like Homo Naledi, this segment is super short.
That was really bad. You're not even segueing. You're just making a bad joke.
No, that's just a bad joke. We're going to move over to Turkey and talk some crap about some toilets back in a minute.
You may have heard my pitch for membership. It's a great idea and really helps out. However, you can also support us by picking up a fun t-shirt, sticker, or something from a large selection of items from our TeePublic store. Head over to arcpodnet.com/shop for a link. That's arcpodnet.com/shop to pick up some fun swag and support the show.
Welcome back to the final segment of episode 146 of the Archaeology Show. And as promised, we're going to talk about some over 2,000-year-old toilets in Turkey. Pretty cool.
Why are toilets so interesting to archaeologists?
I don't know. Yeah, that's all we do is study other people's crap. I don't know what to tell you. So,
I mean, like, the legit answer is because they're usually well-preserved and they people dispose of things in them. And they actually, while they can be quite disgusting to excavate, they actually can have some really great information in them. Mm-hmm. Okay, there you go.
There you go. So, like a lot of ancient excavations in, I would say, you know, the Mediterranean, that area down near Turkey. I mean, the whole area is just lots of things that are well buried under years and years of sediment, and they take a long time to uncover. Mm-hmm. So this excavation that we're talking about near the ancient city, well, in the ancient city of Smyrna, which is located near Turkey's western coastline, what they were excavating is basically a theater area. Mm-hmm. You can see some big steps here where people would have sat. And then there's a whole row of like buildings, basically. And I don't know why they chose to highlight this in this article, or unless they uncover another room, researchers just go publish an article about that room that they uncovered, or, you know, whatever they decided the room was. Maybe that would probably be my guess, because, you know, academics have to publish pretty much all the time to keep their jobs. So as they're excavating and they uncover a new area or see a new thing, then they'll tell the story about that through a paper. That's just how the information gets out.
Well, and archaeology is a very slow process, so it probably took like a whole season of excavation just to
not more.
Yeah, just to get this room uncovered. So pausing to talk about a lavatory seems kind of crazy, but also like it represents a whole season or more of field work. So
First cool thing is this theater dates from around the 2nd century BC and was used into the 5th century AD. Mm-hmm. It just blows me away, some of the time frames. Being from the United States, nothing here that was used for a long time is super old. Now, some of the Native American stuff was used for hundreds of years, if not longer. And that is our example of that, right? In this country. But there are things still being used in some areas of, you know, England and other parts of Europe that, like, I mean, have been used continuously for the past, you know, 500, 600, 700, 800 years. And that's just crazy to me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is totally crazy. And in the ancient world, it seems like things are used even longer than that. Yeah. And it makes me wonder, because like something that was in use, you know, 500 or 600 years ago in Europe, it looks totally different today than it did 600 years ago when it was built, probably. Yeah. We've had to do a lot of reinforcing to, you know, make it still stand properly and all that kind of stuff. And it does make me wonder, when you see a structure in the ancient world built of stone, so probably pretty sturdy, but what kinds of changes and things were done to it over the years to make it able to be continually used for as long as it was? That would be an interesting topic to look at.
Yeah, I'm sure there would have to have been repair work to the stone and possibly even modifications. But a lot of these things, you look at these huge stone blocks that make up some of the rooms and the buildings here, that stuff hasn't more than likely moved. You know, maybe they added another row to block off a room or something like that, or to divide a room. But you know, that stuff would have been pretty challenging and not really that worth it, I would think, to move. But the interior decorations and stuff obviously changed over time. Maybe even some of the use and function of it changed over time. But, you know, that being said, why, you know, if it's not broke, don't fix it. So,
yeah. Well, the like ancient architecture is really hard for me to wrap my head around sometimes because we only see the stone foundations and the stone walls. And but there must have been wood structures as part of it as well, right? Wood beams to hold up roofing or maybe add additional separations within the structure and stuff like that. And without having the actual wood left, it's hard for me to like wrap my head around what the actual building would have looked like. And also thinking about the evolution of a structure through time, like the changing up that the wood elements of it would be something that would probably happen naturally because wood just decomposes and degrades over time.
Well, I'm curious too as to, you know, if they used it for 600 years or 700 years, like why did they stop using it? What caused that?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Was it an earthquake? Was it a, you know, major destruction, too much to bring it in and just no will to keep it going? I mean, there was probably an owner, even if it was the city, so to speak. So let's talk about the toilets real quick. So, I mean, the thing that the article is here for.
Literally never said that before, but yes, let's talk about the toilets.
Let's talk about them. So they were found within an enclosed area. I would hope so. And the toilet seats stood about 16 inches high, and they're not really pointing them out in the picture in this archaeology.org article, but I think I can tell which ones they are. They look like they're orange with basically toilet seat holes kind of things.
Yeah, yeah.
They said the seats were about 16 inches high, which would seem to fit for an adult using it. They had room for about a dozen seats in a U-shaped arrangement. So I'm not actually sure if what we're looking at in the picture is what I'm saying, because that is not a U-shaped arrangement. But either way, it's interesting about this thing because they're all right next to each other, right? Now, we don't know. I mean, maybe we do historically, maybe there's pictures, but I don't know personally what kind of separation there may have been, so to speak. Like if you had a, I mean, are you just sitting there on the toilet next to somebody else? You know,
I mean,
or are you sitting down while if it's a man, like the man is just facing you and like peeing into the toilet? Like, are the women and men sitting next to each other? And
it makes I don't know.
It makes me wonder a lot of times, you know, back in these ancient times, especially in like, you know, the Roman and Greek areas, that kind of modesty that we have today just wasn't there. And it makes me wonder if our modesty developed over time with more insular family units and less being around other people like that. Like we had, you know, houses that kept us indoors rather than outdoors. Or did our modesty develop with, I don't know, toilet technology, like putting up walls in the stalls? Did we develop that modesty and now we're just, we just don't want to show that to people? I mean, guys still pee standing next to each other.
You do.
In a trough.
That's
so
true.
Not much has changed there.
Yeah. Yeah, that's definitely true. And I found another picture and I think that that sort of orange block is what they're saying. That's like a reconstructed,
it's like bank of toilets.
Yeah, it's like it's a reconstruction of what they think that it looked like, but you can see it is kind of U-shaped.
Yeah.
That front part is sort of cut out there and then it would have gone all the way around the building, I think is what they're saying. But yeah, I don't know. The like it's a very not private way to use the facilities. But maybe that makes sense based on who these toilets were for. Because they are speculating, or not speculating, they have some pretty good proof that these are the toilets for the actors performing in the theater rather than for the paying, you know, patrons of the theater. So I guess I could see it being like, well, you're here to work and this is the toilet you get and you deal with it.
Also makes you wonder about big events like that. I'm thinking about like the Roman Colosseum or something as obviously a dramatic example of this, but you've got 10,000 people in this Colosseum for an event. They do have to go to the bathroom pretty regularly. That much hasn't changed.
You got to deal with it. You just have to.
But how did they deal with it? I mean, we barely deal with it very well now. I mean, I would say we deal with it poorly now with big long lines at bathrooms and poorly functioning bathrooms. I mean,
porta potties, all that.
How was sanitation back then? I don't know.
Well, I think the big trough aspect of it is the thing that made it work is you dig a deep enough hole and put the toilets high enough above it, then everything can just drop down below and then
goes into the ground.
Yeah,
there was a trough about 4 inches deep that carried clean water, they think, around this. I'm trying to visualize what that was and what that looked like and what you actually do with it. What do you just like, I don't know, dip your butt in the clean water trough or splash yourself? Or is that for your hands and face? Like, what was the clean water trough for?
Well, maybe
how
it
do
was
you clean up.
Maybe it was more for keeping the actual toilets themselves clean. Like maybe the water went through the trough that all the waste was dropping into. So it kind of kept the area moving. So you never had standing waste sitting there.
I'm sure somebody is typing out an email right now to tell us all about this.
I hope so, because this article, honestly, this article was really lacking in information, and it does seem to just be like an initial, like, look what we found report.
Yeah.
But with not a whole lot of pictures or analysis or close ups of what it was and how it actually worked. They're just saying, look at the bathroom, and like, yeah, that's it. So yeah, I would love to find out more about exactly how this would have worked, because if they were bringing clean water in to basically clean out the waste, and then you had no standing waste, and it wasn't, mm-hmm, it would keep it from getting smelly, like, and being super gross, like, yeah, that is pretty innovative, actually, which wouldn't surprise me for, you know, sure, the people of that time period. They had quite sophisticated water systems and irrigation, yeah, systems in that part of the world. So that would make sense. So
yeah, if anybody had it figured out, they did. So
yeah, definitely. Definitely. Right. So
I think it'd be super cool to get something like this excavated and then hold a show here. You know, reconstruct it.
Oh,
and then
that would
have
be
like
so cool.
A show there. Yeah. There's got to be some ancient theaters where people
gotta
are doing
be.
That.
Oh, I'm sure. There's got to be.
Don't
in
they do
Rome.
That in Pompeii? Because we saw one of the ancient theaters in Pompeii. I've got pictures of us standing, like, I think on the top where the top of the seats were away,
yeah,
from the stage.
Mm-hmm.
It was fully excavated. There's, yeah, no reason you couldn't hold a show there.
Yeah, I bet people, yeah, do. I mean,
yeah, that'd be really neat.
It would be really cool to experience it just like they did 2,000 or 4,000 years ago, yeah, or whatever it is.
But maybe like bring in some bathrooms, because I don't think I'm using the clean water trough to dip in.
I don't think you need to dip your butt in the water.
I think I'm
okay?
dipping in the butt. I think I'm dipping in the clean water trough. That's what's happening.
Oh, my God. Okay, first of all, like just don't poop in public.
I mean,
like,
sometimes
start,
you just
start
have
there.
To. Sometimes
just
you
start
have to.
There. Just don't do it.
Well, okay, so here's the other question, because, you know, we've been to, God, where was that? I guess they had toilet seats 2,000 years ago here in Turkey, because when I was in Africa, mm-hmm, back in 2005 or whatever it was, they have, like, they call them, I think they call them English or American style toilets, and then African toilets. And African toilets, like in the same bathroom, you might have one that's an actual toilet, and it's a very rudimentary,
like, toilet seat,
like, in thing that you sit on.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. The other stalls are a hole in the ground, because they prefer to just squat. Mm. I mean, that's what they want to do.
Yeah.
Right? They know toilets exist, but they prefer to just squat. And I'm just like, it's interesting the different ideas around that, because these are actual toilet seats.
Yeah.
And this was, and I'm sure if you're looking at, you know, the consumable materials that would have been on this, there was probably some sort of, you know, comfortable seat. You're not just putting your butt on the rock or whatever this was made out of.
Yeah.
You know, there was probably some sort of comfort level to it. If you're going to go through the trouble of making a seat to sit on, then you're probably going to do something to make it a little more comfortable. But they definitely had the means to do that.
Yeah. I mean, the reconstruction looks like they just built like a wooden seat with,
yeah,
the holes in it. So, yeah, which so would certainly get the job done. It's simple, but
yeah, we, yeah, don't need it to be complicated, for sure.
Yeah.
So, but it's just interesting around the world how people have done stuff. And it always reminds me of the Jerry Seinfeld joke about Chinese people using chopsticks. He's like, what is with these people still using chopsticks? They've seen the fork. Like, it's not easy, oh, but yet culturally they just stick with it.
Yeah.
And I kind of agree. Like, you know, for some reason, like, eating like sushi with chopsticks seems to work, because they're sort of conducive to like a two-stick sort of maneuver. And if you were to poke it with a fork, I don't think it would work as well. But, and you also don't want to just like pick it up with your fingers, which is the other option. But I'm like, rice? Come on. Give me a spoon.
It's just a different style of eating. It's more of a shoveling.
Yeah, but it's,
your bowl is close to your mouth and it's a shoveling,
yeah,
you know?
I mean, I hear
ya. It's just a different cultural approach to eating.
But it's clearly less efficient.
Okay. Well,
I just can't handle
it. Have a feeling there's a lot of Chinese people and Asian people who would disagree with you.
I know,
so
there's a lot of angry emails being typed right now.
I know, and they probably should, because
yeah, send them to Tristan at archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
No, I mean, the way that people eat and the way they dispose of waste and all the different things that they do, it's just gonna be different culturally, and the way you do it, the way you're brought up doing it, just seems like the, yeah, normal and right way. And changing that, I think, is really difficult for for people to do. So
right.
I get it.
All right. Well, that was crappy. So so we're done for this episode. Those were some articles bouncing all around the world. So, yeah, if you are listening to this in real time, have a good Thanksgiving in the United States next week. Mm-hmm. If you're not in the United States, then, you know, have some turkey anyway. Who knows?
Nah, have mashed potatoes. That's what everybody's really at Thanksgiving for.
Something everybody in the world can come together
yeah.
with. And I could eat some mashed potatoes with some chopsticks. So as long as they're not too runny.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
Anyway, I'm eating Thanksgiving dinner next week with chopsticks.
Oh, my mom will just love that. You should definitely do it.
I'm going to do it.
Okay.
All right.
It's a plan.
See you guys next week.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.arcpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at arcpodnet. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day.
This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Cultural Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.